And one passage in particular struck me. She was this peculiar combination of bad mash and little girl. Even before he visited her house, he knew she had a whole collection of stuffed animals avalanche on her bed. And there was something in the seamlessness with which she switched between these aspects that convinced him that both were masks. That there existed a third Anna, a hidden Anna, who determined what mask to throw up for what occasion, but who was otherwise obscure and impossible to know. I know, Juno Diaz is no slouch. And so after reading that and letting it marinate for a bit, it struck me that likely most of us here could be viewed in the same manner, as containing a number of personas that we glide seamlessly between, all of which are ruled by another obscure and impossible self. Take, for example, Brandy Bradley. Because on one hand, we've all seen her charging through Williams with her giant hot pink backpack bouncing on her shoulder and that wild red hair, and of course, the vintage cowboy boots, which, yes, might be cozy and soft enough for her to hike all over campus, but which also possess some sly, wicked-looking tips. And yet, if you've been in workshop with her, you know that she will respond to your stories not only with piercing intelligence and insight and that trademark Brandy Bradley sense of humor, but also with a sort of generous, kind-hearted, bullshit-free feedback that doesn't make you want to go home and weep into your beer in the dark. But which instead bears you up and sustains you as you gather the courage to go back into the test. Once, Brandy sat with me at a hot table in the Starbucks exposure, listening to my fears and tolerating my anxieties, and softly, calmly, talked me down from the ledge. Another day, this was sometime last autumn, we were chatting late one afternoon in Dodd's basement while the machinery in the walls behind us emitted ghoulish sounds as though Jodie Foster's lambs were being slaughtered. And as we sat there alone in that dim underground chamber, the conversation quietly turned to loss and death, and those who love were no longer. This is my first year at FSU, and already I know that most, if not all of us, have suffered loss. I can look out at all of you right now and see the ghost sitting here among us. And I suspect there's one standing here on this platform with me. And I know that Brandy, like many of us, which brings me to that third spectral self that Juno Diaz writes about. I don't know, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that this self is the one that inhabits and that haunts our poems and our essays and our stories and our novels. And I could stand up here all night and tell you about Bad Mash Brandy and her alter ego, but as far as that other hidden spooky self, Millie almost convinced herself that she was looking at a highly detailed lawn ornament. until it blinked. Even then, she doubted what she saw, squinting at the trio from her vehicle while she barked orders to her assistant, Stacy, on her cell phone. Don't let Todd pull that mess with you just because I'm out of office. No, you call him back and tell him that we will not accept credit for the door knockings that never arrived. We want the full order overnighted immediately. Fine. Call me back later. I'm here now. She clicked the button on her Bluetooth device to disconnect, still watching the cats, waiting for one to do something other than stare at the house she and her brother had just bought. She flipped a quick text to her husband, Charles, telling him she had arrived. The cats did not scatter when she slammed her door, close enough now that she could see their fur rustle with their synchronized breathing. She'd never seen cats stay in one spot that long before. Their heads did not flick back and forth like stalking bird or mouse. The yellow one on the end opened its mouth for a yawn or a hiss, and the movement sent a shudder down the woman's back. She wanted to pick a rock from the gravel drive and pitch it toward them to make them move, but instead she hissed, "Scat," which they ignored. In the yard, leaning against the flatbed truck, waited for brother Marvin and nephew Roy. Millicent and Marvin did not hug. They were not those kind of siblings. "How are you?" he nodded in her direction. Roy spat into the dirt, then leaned in for his usual cat hug. Roy was 10 years old and looked like a travel-sized version of Marv. Roy was not his given name. The name on his birth certificate was Hunter Andrew Carter. But Marv took to calling the boy Roy in the womb as a way to torment his pregnant wife, who cringed at naming her son something so similar to what one would name a dog. But both sides of the family got in on the joke, and the name never faded. When he went to school and they called attendance, he had to explain on the first day that no one called him Hunter. Millie asked what was wrong with those cats, to which Marv responded, "What cats?" She pointed at the trio by the dogwood trees, and Roy said, "They're scared." "Scared cats run," Millie said, although she'd never owned a cat and couldn't comment on her behavior. "Maybe they're too scared." Marv rolled his eyes at both of them. "You didn't drive 2 hours this morning to talk about weird cats. You didn't have to drive in at all." Marv had called her a couple of months ago, explaining that Mr. Edgar Williams had died, moving his house available for sale. Mr. Williams was a short man, and when Millie was a girl, she would see him sitting at the hardware store downtown, drinking coffee and chatting with the other men. The surviving children wanted to get rid of the house quickly, leaving the furniture and most of the man's belongings. Marv wanted to buy the house and fix it up to sell it. He asked for a loan. Millie heard partnership. The house needed work. Marv wanted to gut the kitchen and the bathrooms, plain tile, repair the roof, and knock out the wall that separated the kitchen from the dining room. With Roy on her heels, they walked through each room, looking at closets and measuring things. They knocked on walls, and Marv crawled under the house to check the floors, the plumbing, and search for any evidence of mold. As self-appointed contractor, Marv had planned on spending the day emptying the house so a crew could begin demolition the next day, stripping the place down to the walls. "We should probably get a trailer," Millie said, "and I can go through these cabinets, just throw it all in boxes, and haul it off to Goodwill. Roy, you want to run out and grab you some boxes real quick?" "Hey, what are you bossing him around for? You ain't in charge here." Marv turned to Roy and jerked his head toward the door. "Run out and get those boxes, boy." They worked the rest of the day, making a quick and dirty job of clearing out years of accumulation. They emptied the entire contents of drawers into boxes, watching photos float with the cardboard along with the stray playing cards, old fuses, recipes, screwdrivers, and bank statements. They did not pause to sort anything they found. A year before, Marv and Millie had come together to clear out their own mother's house. It was the last task they had completed after their mother's death. They'd already mailed all the thank you cards, paid the mortician and the florist, tossed all her bank accounts, closed all her bank accounts, and signed the paperwork for the life insurance. Millie's portion of the estate sat in an IRA, while she was certain her brother's share was something for this investment. When they cleaned their mother's house, they took particular care, at first anyway, assigning each other's caretaker of their mother's belongings like they were curating a museum in their parents' honor. Millie took the photo albums and memorabilia,
Mars took her shotgun in her father's old radio pack. After a while, they became disenchanted and dumped things into boxes in a frenzy to finish. In Mr. Baker's bedroom, Millie set her eyes on a pair of boots she found in the closet. They had aged well, not one snag in the embroidered stitching. The toes were only slightly scuffed, more gray than black. They must have only been worn on special occasions, preserved in likely the same box which they'd been purchased. She slid them on, noting Mr. Baker's tiny feet. They fit her perfectly. Marv walked past with an armful of DVDs and saw her admiring herself in the boots. Don't wear a dead man's boots. Why? Is it bad luck? Well, sure, she ain't good luck. She ignored him, and when they hauled the bedroom items onto the trailer, she sneaked the boots into the back of her SUV. When she slammed the door closed, she caught the faint sound of music, like a radio playing in the distance. She couldn't quite place the song, but recognized one part and hummed it. Around lunch, Mark's wife, Kara, pulled into the drive and pitched a bag of burgers to Roy. Millie couldn't have sworn that her sister-in-law had even brought her pickup truck to a complete stop. She only caught a glimpse of the scrubs Kara wore to work as a receptionist at the local doctor's office. Marv kept working, keeping an extra burger tucked in one of the pockets on his cargo shorts. Millie and Roy ate their burgers on the steps of the porch while drinking root beers from a cooler kept in the back of Marv's truck. Millie was not disappointed her brother did not join her to eat. He had never been much of a talker. And after they were no longer required to make daily, sometimes hourly phone calls discussing their mother's health, Millie noted that they struggled to know what else to discuss. Besides, she enjoyed conversing with Roy more than most adults. They told you this place was haunted? Roy said with his mouth full of lime. Haunted? That's not true. Who told you that? It is true. Miss Alice next door told me that the cats won't come near this house no more. Now you know it must be haunted bad if the cats don't want to come near it, because cats normally like us. Millie looked at the dogwood trees for the creepy cats, but didn't see them lingering on the edges of the property. Their absence created a crawling sensation down her arms. She felt like she'd walked into a tense meeting or a party where someone not invited eats all the cake. Come on, you don't really believe in ghosts, do you? Well, don't you? You know, Papa still hangs around a lot near our house. Daddy says it smells like candle cigarettes, and he says sometimes he can see Papa standing under the security light by the barn. He even tells Papa good night. She took a drink from her can. What did your daddy tell you about Papa? That he used to ride the rodeo when he got throwed, and that's why Daddy won't ride bulls. Millie nodded, feeling Marv had summed it up. She barely knew her father. She was young when he had died. She can still recall the smell of the rodeo, fresh turned arena dirt and horse shit. Every year, the family would be asked to attend the annual county fair 4-H rodeo so the cowboys could pay tribute to their father. They'd dedicate the cowboys' prayer to him, and all the bull riders would stand in the middle of the arena with their hats over their hearts. She and Marv always came home emotional, and their mother would retire to her room. Eventually, they stopped going. Millie watched Roy out of the corner of her eye. Millie had never said much stopping ghost stories, even though sometimes she often felt like her mother was riding in the truck with her, asking how Millie could stand driving in all that Nashville traffic. But she assumed that was some combination of grief and imagination. That's how ghost stories spread. She figured that was also what Marv saw in the backyard. By the end of the day, they had hauled away about three trailers worth of things to Goodwill or the dump, with the exception of a blue automated reclining chair, like one would have had in a nursing home. It was too heavy for both Millie and Marv, even with the help of Roy. They agreed to leave it until the men arrived the next day for the kitchen demolition. Millie was filthy and tired. You gonna give me your bed tonight, Roy? No, that's where Mama Claire's sleeping tonight. Millie looked at Marv. Oh, I guess I'll be sleeping on your couch. Marv shook his head and explained that his mother-in-law's house was being fumigated and she was spending the week with him. It's already too crowded. Come on, I can't sleep on your couch. It's one night. You didn't give us any notice. I can't plan for that. The idea that he would not be able to provide her a place to sleep had never occurred to her. She hadn't even called him before she left that morning, but waited until she'd driven half the distance outside of Bucksmore when her cell service popped back on. So what am I supposed to do? Well, you could stay at the motel off Highway 20. And she told him to be serious. She didn't believe Mr. Edgar's house was haunted, but that motel might be. It was an establishment that secured its position in the community as a place for teenagers to lose their virginity and get high. You could stay here. The electricity and the water's still on. Before she had a chance to respond, Roy approached. If you're scared because it's haunted, I'll stay with you. Hush up, boy, get in the truck. It's true, Daddy. He popped the piece of gum in his mouth. The cats. The cats don't come over anymore. Miss Alice didn't tell me. Mark clicked and grunted at the boy the same way he did his dog, and Roy sulked all the way to the truck. Millie looked at her brother. You don't really think this house is haunted, do you? He shrugged at her in that familiar way that he did when they were kids. That face usually accompanied a blubber of, I don't know. He told her to follow him to the house, and he'd make sure she got dinner. Roy hung out of the window of the truck and called over to them. I'll stay with you, Aunt Millie. I will. I ain't scared. After dinner, Millie walked back to Mr. Edgar's house, lugging her an overnight bag, an inflatable mattress, and a bag of snacks from the gas station, which included Toll House cookies, potato chips, and two Diet Cokes. Her portion of dinner at her brother's house consisted of a dollop of mashed potatoes and half a pork chop, which she had shared with her eldest nephew, Marvin Jr., who spent most of the meal distracted and wearing a vague smile. Kara and her mother stayed glued to the Weather Channel tracking to see if a tornado was likely that night. Marv and Roy walked Millie to her truck to say goodnight, and Roy again asked if he could go back to the haunted house with Millie, and was denied. She promised she'd tell him all about the ghost if she saw it. Marv offered to pitch a tent in the backyard if she was too scared. Then, in absolutely no attempt to comfort, he said, if you're going to be scared of something out here, it would be the vet heads busting in looking to rip the copper out of the walls. Be sure to put a lock on the door. Now she was hungry, tired, and terrified of meth heads. Once the air mattress was inflated, she slipped into an old t-shirt to sleep in and snuggled under the blanket she kept in the back of her truck for emergencies. She called Charles and spoke to her children, who were still awake. Millie chastised her husband for not putting him to bed on time, and then told him that she loved him. After she hung up and plugged her phone into charge, she felt herself doze off with images of crazy meth heads and ghosts flooding her brain. A coughing noise woke her. She discovered half a cookie was still in her hand with only one bite missing. But the coughing sound had roused her, a rattling cough coming from the direction of the blue chair neither she nor Mark had been strong enough to lift. Raspy and wet, the cough reminded her of a longtime smoker. She didn't want to look. It was one of those defining moments where one has to decide if ignorance is, in fact, bliss. When she rolled over, her eyes adjusted to the room, now lit with a desk lamp she held onto from the purge. She saw something sitting in the blue chair, which looked like a blob of flesh. It had few contours, like someone had dumped a mound of clay onto a wheel. Millie could almost perceive a face, but what she took for squinty eyes could have been the illusion created by the folds of wrinkles and loose skin. The flesh elsewhere looked bubbly. It was Jabba the Hutt with boobs and a bob haircut, draped in red and what looked like an old nylon nightgown. When the blob stopped coughing, it settled its eyes on Millie. Who the hell are you? I'm Millie. Who the hell are you? Well, I'm Roseanne, and this is my house. No, this is my house. Millie didn't feel scared of this blob. It looked sad, practically oozing onto the floor. I bought it. Roseanne coughed again, and it rattled the windows, her eyes watering from the forest, perhaps, or maybe tears. Can you help me find my husband? Millie rolled over on the mattress, turning her back to the blob, telling herself it was a dream. She closed her eyes and made every mental attempt to wake herself up. Roseanne whined, then coughed so hard it made Millie's chest hurt. I just don't know why I can't find him. Millie's eyes remained shut. Maybe he moved on, you know, walked into the light. The blob made a fart noise with its blubbery mouth. That man couldn't find his ass with both hands, much less the other side. Oh, Ruth Ann, you don't give him enough credit. He's probably on the other side right now. You should go join him. Nope. He's here. He's here in this house. I know it. We just gotta find him. Lily flipped over and faced her nuisance, shaking her head. Ruth Ann cried, I can't do it alone. I can't get out of this chair. Lily sat up. I don't think that's how ghosts work. Well, what do you know? You ain't never been a ghost before. If you really want to get to sleep tonight, you better start looking. Ruth Ann coughed again, wet and raspy, and then smacked her lips like an old lady whose teeth rested in a jar of cleaning solution in another room. I guess I'll be in this house forever. Millie didn't like that. She wondered what problems a ghost could cause for the sale of the house. Miss Alice next door was already convinced it was haunted. That might help sell it. Guess so, Millie said. It's okay. Stay in the house. Haunted for years. Then the ghost began to talk and talk and talk. Millie tried to block out the noise, but Ruth Ann's voice was inescapable. Even when she went into the bathroom, Ruth Ann's voice remained as clear as when they sat in the room together. Mill had no recollection of this woman alive. Didn't remember seeing her either at church or in town. She could not connect her to one of the many elders with whom her mother chatted with at the grocery store. But that voice, she would have remembered. Deep and scratchy, rattling down the ear canal. Ruth Ann talked about her being great children and her hopeless. One story led to another with barely any pause. Well, when was I supposed to have time for myself? I swear, sometimes I want to just walk out the door and just keep walking. Walk all the way to Memphis. Finally, get to see Graceland. Oh, I love Elvis so much. I never got to see him perform before he died. I mean, I was only a girl when he was performing, you know, before he got fat. But I always loved to expand his parade. Sometimes I wonder if maybe I'll run into his ghost because so many people say he's not dead. Not requiring breath, Ruth Ann never had to pause. Millie thought this would be how she'd run off the new homeowners. Oh God, Ruth Ann, shut up already. Oh, you can hear me. Good. Millie paced around the room. When Ruth Ann stopped talking, Millie could hear the wind whipping around the house. She decided to try and talk Ruth Ann out of the idea that her husband was somewhere hiding in a closet, a cabinet somewhere, but she was not convinced. If I'm stuck in this chair, he could be stuck in the attic or something. I'm not climbing up in that attic. There could be rats up there. Millie placed her hands on her hips. Wait, if you're stuck in that chair, then I can't wait to see what happens tomorrow when the men come all out of the chair out of here. Her voice rose. Don't you dare force me to haunt the Goodwill forever. Millie shrugged, feeling delightfully smug. I guess we'll just have to cross over. She kneeled down in front of Ruth Ann's chair. Come on, walk into the light. It is a light, right? Yeah, it is. But the light's getting dimmer. I'm worried it might be too late. Can you please help me? All right, I'll make you a deal. Millie looked down at her watch and saw that it was only 10:05 p.m. She wondered how I could possibly be so early when it felt like 3 a.m. I will look until midnight for your ghost husband. If I can't find him, you will have to cross over without him. Promise? I'm not promising anything. Why not? Millie plopped her butt down on the floor and sat with her legs crossed, looking up at the blobby ghost. Ruth Ann looked at Millie's wedding ring. You've been married, what, 5, maybe 10 years? I married that man when I was 17 years old. We have over 60 years together. He is all I know. My parents died, my children moved away, Bridget died, but Edgar, he was there. When Ruth Ann told this story, her blob began to develop into a shape. When it was in a pile of unformed flesh, she began to take the form of a woman, as though she were being inflated like a child's bounce house. As she expanded, her flesh became transparent, and Millie could see through to a scene of a couple dancing together. The woman's hair had been styled in hot rollers, and she wore a pink blouse dripping in white paint. And when he spun her around the fringe furl, and the beads sparkled like rain, she was laughing. Millie could not see the man in the image, only his back. and the boot she found in the closet and hid in her truck. He was holding my hand when I had the stroke. The last thing I remember, his hand was in mine. I woke up in the night and I shook him because I felt funny, and he grabbed my hand, and that was it. Millie felt herself soften, both terrified of dying in her sleep, but longing that the last earthly moment would be of her husband's hand in her own. Fine. Where do you think he might be? Millie searched the house as best she could. Every overlight in every room burned. 3 bedrooms, living room, 2 bathrooms, dining room, kitchen, utility room. She pulled every chain and every closet. The only thing she discovered during her excursion was the assurance that purchasing the house was a good investment, and a small bottle of Canadian mist hidden in the space where the washer and dryer connected to the water line. When she came back into the living room, Ruth Ann was sitting less blob-like in the chair, as if her story had solidified her somehow. Did you find it? No, but I found this. Millie held up the bottle. He lived here alone. I wonder who your husband was hiding this from. Well, that wasn't his. That was mine. Millie murmured a noise, possibly an O. She sat in front of Ruth Ann and opened the bottle. The liquid smelled ethereal. She took a sip and it evaporated on her tongue and shivered down her throat. I bet you really wish you had a little bit of this. No, she coughed. Done with all that. And your husband, too. Is that why your kids didn't come get anything in your house? They're so mad at y'all. Ruth Ann was quiet. Millie passed the bottle between her hands, feeling the liquid shift. Sometimes when she was home alone as a teenager, she'd sneak into her mother's bedroom and pull out a poorly hidden bottle of Crown Royal, passing it back and forth in her hands the same way. The kids ask you to quit drinking? They never knew. Yeah, they did. The kids always know. When Millie and Mark cleaned out their own mother's house, they had found 5 bottles of liquor hidden in the oddest of places. In an overnight bag, in the bedside drawer, under a pile of dirty laundry, under the couch, and sealed in a fall guy lunchbox in the garage, almost all vodka, some of them near empty gallon-sized containers. Multiple organ failure. That's what they call it when the body breaks down from alcohol abuse. Millie thought Ruth Ann should feel blessed she had a stroke. At least it was quick. When her mother slipped into a coma, she seized on and off until the doctors convinced her and Mark to remove her from the ventilation, which had been keeping her alive. And then she continued to fight for another 7 days. Millie had sat with her mother in the evenings at the hospital, praying that she would live, or if she couldn't live, if that was too much to ask, then to just die. She didn't want to have to make the decision to pull the plug on her mom. It was too much, and Mark was too angry. As children, they become accustomed to the culture of beer-drinking daddies. Even though they never knew their own that well, all of their friends growing up had one. But mothers were somehow supposed to be above that behavior. Mark wouldn't even go to the funeral home to pick out her casket. Whatever affection Millie had developed for Ruth Ann that evening had withered, and she could not give a shit if she found it her now. She wanted that ghost lady out of her house. All right, Ruth Ann, I've looked in every room, I've checked every closet and cabinet. I think you ever realized that he might not be here. It seemed like Ruth Ann was crying, but it was difficult for Millie to tell. And now Millie saw the crying as some sort of performance to gain sympathy, and she rolled her eyes. Ruth Ann noticed, oh, you mad now? Why not, she thought. Why not just be mad? She'd been working with a therapist for months now, trying to stop being angry. Why, when being mad felt so satisfying? What she hated was how often she had to lie about it. Ruth Ann, I am not mad. I am sick of encouraging you to leave my house. Your house? Yes, my money, my loan, my house, my truck, my business, my life, my life, my life. I love Charles, but that love doesn't own me. I choose to love him every morning when I work to make him happy. When it is time for me to cross over to the other side, I will meet him there. What you were doing isn't romantic, especially since it didn't work, because he ain't here. They sat in silence for a moment, and the wind gutted, and the wind gusted around the house again. Millie often fretted over tornadoes, but tonight she wished the roof would be ripped off this house and take that ghost in its ugly chair with it. Millie stood and walked back to her pallet. Cross over or don't cross over, I do not care. I'm going to bed. she could in the chair and closed her eyes. I'm gone. She began to make sounds like a ghost in a Casper cartoon. I'm going into the light. Ooh, I'm frosted up. Wait, did you check that toolbox in the backyard? So Millie checked the toolbox, the shed, back in the attic again, the bathroom, the kitchen faucets. Do you want me to look at my phone and find you a ghost hunter? Because I am all out of ideas. Bree then asked if Millie would consider not hauling away the chair. And then she asked if it was possible that she might still get to stay in the house without it. I don't know the rules. You were my first ghost encounter. Millie thought about the demolition plans and the crew who would lay new tile in the kitchen and rip out the wall and make the open floor plan. It won't be the same place. Why would you want to stay? What's my home? In the distance, Millie could hear a sound under the wind, that part of the song that had nagged her brain all day. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. Finally, she was struck with a wave of recognition that stopped her cold. The words sat on the tip of her tongue. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. She hadn't recognized that she'd been singing it out loud when Roseanne said, "Who used to dance to that?" Millie stood and listened for the notes again, but the wind was too strong. What? Roseanne, watching Millie pacing, and shushed her. Let's go to look in my Texas. Wailing and really young, the boys. Millie walked through the bedrooms, the bathroom, by the attic door, but the noise grew fainter and the more that she walked. The sound was strongest by the front door. It was somehow outside. Ruthanne repeated, "What? What is it? What do you hear?" At that moment, county weather sirens blasted and the wind was now almost shaking the house. Millie remembered the boots. She had put the boots in the back of her vehicle. She ran outside into the blackness. The wind kicked up her t-shirt and blew her hair. Leaves spun around her when she popped open the back of her with her key fob and snatched the boots from her truck. She ran back into the house, leaving the door open behind her. The boots lay docile in their container. She listened for the song, but heard nothing but the sirens and the chugging wind outside. She grabbed one of the boots and shook it upside down like a cup of Yahtzee dice in a form, plopped out and rolled across the carpet. When it had stopped rolling, it unfurled, and Millie could see the tiny man. Ruthanne! He dusted off his clothes, the same Western outfit she'd seen dancing before. Hell, baby, I figured if I sang long enough, you'd find me. He grew taller as he spoke, eventually to the size Millie assumed was his earthly height. He was a petite man, after all. Millie watched Ruthanne, surprised she wasn't reacting, but the ghost had been waiting for this moment for a long time. Perhaps she needed a moment to adjust to him being present. She coughed and cackled. I was right! I knew you wouldn't go nowhere without me. Then Ruthanne began to grow. This mountain of flesh from which she sat expanded like a marshmallow in a microwave. Edgar held out a small hand. We need to go on now. And the wind blew through the open door so strong that it startled Millie. She jumped into a corner and crouched, covering her head like she'd been taught in elementary school during tornado drills. The pressure made her ears pop. She peeked through her knees to see Edgar and Ruthanne clasp hands, and when she blinked, they were gone. The wind stopped blowing. Emerging from the corner, Millie stared at the chair, now empty. The house was quiet. The relief and satisfaction she had anticipated from ridding the house of this ghost never manifested. Instead, she felt hollow and couldn't bear to be in the house anymore. Once she heard the all-clear siren, she gathered her things and slept the remainder of the night locked in her truck. The next morning, Mark knocked on the door of the vehicle and woke her. She sat up and opened the door to his smirking face. You get scared? Yeah, something like that. I tried to call last night until you come back to the house when the weather siren went off. She climbed out of the vehicle, stretching her cramped legs and coughed to clear her throat. Well, the crew will be here soon. Go ahead and get ready to boss them all around. Millie shook her head. I think you can handle it. I'm going home. You sure? He handed her a sausage and biscuit from the gas station down the road. She nodded and said he'd call her and keep her updated on the progress. She peeled off the cellophane and asked if Roy was around. She wanted to tell him about the ghost. But he was spending his day with Mama Claire. Marv, you ever think about Mom? He shrugged, trying not to. She took a bite and with her mouth full of dry biscuit asked, "You mad?" He's back into the yard, not as much as I used to be. "Yeah, me too." She took the last bite and leaned toward Marv. They weren't the type of hug, so they didn't quite know how. She pressed her face into his chest and wrapped her arms around his waist. He felt like warm granite. He patted her on the back. "What happened to you last night?" "Hell, I don't know." Thank you. Thank you.